Hey, I'm Josh Barrow, your new host of Left, Right, and Center. Every week, join Rich Lowry, Bob Scheer, and me for a contentious yet civilized debate of the week's big political stories, from ISIS to the U.S. economy to this 47-candidate presidential election we're having. You can find Left, Right, and Center on KCRW's iTunes page.
The ideal, of course, is a country where everyone has an equal chance to perform, where jobs exist for everyone who wants one, where we live in harmony with each other, and where everyone has a decent place in which to live. The American reality, of course, is something radically different from that. All of us know that most American cities are in trouble, that poverty continues in the middle of wealth, that malnutrition is widespread, that injustice does exist. In short, we know that our society doesn't function the way it might.
That's civil rights pioneer Julian Bond giving a speech at UCLA in 1973. But let's face it, those words could have been said yesterday. Bond passed away over the weekend at the age of 75. He fought for equality and justice throughout his life. He is one of the original leaders of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or SNCC, back in the 1960s. He co-founded the Southern Poverty Law Center, and he headed up the NAACP, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, from 1998 through the 2000s. As we remember Bond's life as an activist and leader, we'd like to take a look now at the NAACP. The organization, of course, has fought against racism and discrimination for more than a century. But how relevant is it in addressing the issues of the black community, and how does the old guard fit in with an emboldened campaign against police brutality and the Black Lives Matter movement? Jody Armour is professor of law at USC. Hi, Jody. Welcome.
Good to be with you, Steve.
We also have Danielle Belton, who writes for the website The Root. Danielle, thank you for being here as well.
Thank you for having me.
You bet. Jody, I'm going to start with you. Can you tell us briefly about the origins of the NAACP? I mean, was this a movement born out of anger similar to what we're seeing today, a la Black Lives Matter?
Yeah, well, W.E.B. Du Bois was an important black leader and intellectual figure, towering intellectual figure, was one of the founders, and the idea was to move toward a more integrated and equal society, and the NAACP carried that banner very well for many years. Thurgood Marshall was the NAACP legal defense leader for a good time, and brought, you know, Brown versus Board of Education and other important civil rights cases. And the NAACP was at the very vanguard of making sure that the country achieved integration. It got rid of Jim Crow, number one, which it did, and extended voting rights to a large chunk of its citizens, black Americans, who were denied them for many years until the 60s. And then, you know, fair housing. So it did a lot to dismantle formal inequality. The question, though, is did it do enough to tackle the problems of economic inequality, structural inequality, and it's subject to some criticisms as we go on in our discussion along those lines. It seemed to have helped the black bourgeoisie, middle-class blacks, a lot, but truly disadvantaged blacks don't seem to have gotten much better in their plight over the last 50 years, despite the NAACP victory.
Jody, I do want to say, though, you mentioned Thurgood Marshall, who, of course, became famously a Supreme Court justice. Was it a certain incident? I know back 100 years ago or longer in this country, it was post-Civil War, there was just overt racial discrimination, killings, lynchings of black people all across the country, particularly, of course, in the South. Was it one incident that started it? Jody, and I'll bring Danielle in as well.
It was a concatenation of travesties and incidents, you know, that came to a head, as often is the case in situations like this and in the creation of organizations like the NAACP. No one even just precipitating incident standing alone, but the cumulative weight. And it took on this mission, and, you know, hopefully we'll get into whether that mission needs to go further today.
Danielle, Jody mentioned bourgeois, that maybe it helped the higher-up folks, right, and not so much the people in the communities, in the areas that are blighted these days. What do you think the NAACP is doing now?
Well, like right now, the NAACP is doing this march. It's America's Journey for Justice. It's this 860-mile walk from Selma to Washington, D.C. And they're trying to bring awareness to economic inequality, to police brutality, to different policy measures that the NAACP is trying to push forward. Now, the NAACP, one of the founding issues that it was involved in was anti-lynching. Lynching was a huge problem throughout the South, where you had black men dying every day through mob violence, and that was one of the core issues that kind of brought the NAACP together. And you see that reflected today in today's movement, where it's around police brutality, which a lot of young activists see as a modern lynching of sorts, and as a unifying issue to rally around. And so I feel like the NAACP has a place. It's still highly influential when you get into higher areas of power, but there has been a focus on the middle class, on respectability politics, that you do see a little bit of in the NAACP. And today's movement with Black Lives Matter is really about being more all-encompassing, really about all black people, not necessarily those who, quote-unquote, like speak properly or dress a particular way, but really for everybody. The movement is for everyone. And I feel like that's a good thing. It's putting pressure on the NAACP to kind of be also more all-encompassing in their message. So while they have focused on the rights of black people and have been successful in many regards, I feel like the push from Black Lives Matter and other grassroots movements is causing the NAACP to do some reflection on itself and what its role is that it does have to play in this modern movement.
You think it was caught off guard, the NAACP? Do you think that this, the, you know, not only the police brutality, because there have been issues of police brutality among African Americans for years. It didn't just start with Rodney King. It didn't just start with Michael Brown. It goes back decades.
Yes. Well, you know, I feel like the NAACP has always been kind of focused on these larger overarching issues. So even though the police brutality is a huge issue, I feel like for a lot of people it was a local one, people dealing with their local police departments. And people didn't necessarily see the bigger connection that what was happening in their hometown and in their neighborhood was actually happening across the country. And another thing about the NAACP is the fact that it is local chapters. So you might have a local chapter that is directly dealing with police brutality in this community locally, but the national chapter might be doing something else. I mean, that's where really the difference happens here. Because you see on the grassroots a lot of local NAACP branches who are very active on the ground when there's another police killing or a shooting, who do get involved and who do directly lobby the government and have influence and impact. But I believe in the past you just haven't seen the national organization really. They've talked about police brutality and racial profiling, but not necessarily in the same direct manner that I would say that current Black Lives Matter protesters speak about it.
Jody, do you think, I mean, NAACP, there's a lot of heft behind that movement. It's been around for so long. What can it contribute? And do you think it's chasing, like trying to catch up to Black Lives Matter?
Yeah, you know, no doubt about it at this point. It has to reclaim some credibility after some scandals like Donald Sterling giving him achievement awards to help him absolve himself of his discriminatory sins in housing and other areas. And then that came out. Bill Cosby did his infamous pound cake speech while he was getting an NAACP award, in which he said, you know, the problem is black kids just have to pull up their pants, et cetera, and was wagging his finger and lecturing truly disadvantaged blacks disproportionately while at the same time slipping roofies into women's drinks and raping them from all the evidence that I'm seeing seems to indicate that. So the first degree hypocrisy that a lot of the kids who are truly disadvantaged and being lectured by that kind of NAACP cadre have them lose a lot of legitimacy, and I think they have to reclaim that, and they do have to get in line behind the Black Lives Matter movement to find it.
Bill Cosby notwithstanding, Jody, how much real change do you think has Black Lives Matter and the movement been able to create? Has it moved the needle a little bit?
Here's how you know that it's moved the needle. It's demonstrable. There was a big move, according to the Gallup poll and the Pew Research Center poll recently about 2 weeks ago, that showed over the last year, upwards of 17% to 19% more Americans now view racism as a big problem in America over where they were a year ago. And even more than that are recognizing that we have to make much more racial progress. So it has actually been a consciousness raising and a galvanizing movement unlike any I've seen in my lifetime.
So if you're talking to somebody at the NAACP, were they doing something wrong? Were they not fighting hard enough? Did they not have a good PR campaign if they've been around for decades, a century or more?
I feel like it's not so much that they have necessarily bad PR. It's more that it's an old organization. Some of its methodologies and some of its ways of communication are old. So it's not going to stand out in the same way as Black Lives Matter, which has been very technologically savvy, much more savvy than the NAACP has been in recent years. And also, again, you have to look at the fact that the NAACP is made up of memberships of all these local chapters. So you have some local chapters who are just out there on the forefront who are doing amazing work, like the North Carolina NAACP under Reverend William Barber, who's been behind the Moral Mondays.
The Moral Monday, yeah.
Yeah, so you have some that are doing like in just incredible work around voting, around police brutality, around just a multitude of issues, but it's on the local level. So I think it's just an issue of the national organization still trying to figure out like where do they best fit and trying to adapt to this new environment politically.
Julian Bond, of course, was a trailblazer all those years. Who is the new Julian Bond, do you guys think? Are there leaders within, I don't know, not only the Black Lives Matter movement, but also the NAACP, also on the ground in these different cities across the country?
Well, I feel like there's only really one Julian Bond. I mean, what you have now are young people who are making a name for themselves, who will be themselves coming out of this movement. Like, I really have to give a lot of credit to the women who founded Black Lives Matter, yes. Patrice Cullors, Alicia Garza, and Opal Tamani. I mean, they really are trailblazers in this particular movement and are leaders, but there are tons of different leaders. You have, you know, Phil Agnew with Dream Defenders. You have Dante Berry with Million Hoodies. Mm-hmm. You have Charlene Carruthers with BYP 100. There are a lot of people who are active right now in this current social justice movement who are doing really remarkable things and will make names for themselves in their own right.
Is the difference like this way that people get the information out as opposed to like back then they didn't have this technology? Now people are instantaneous in how they get the information. Do you think it's different and that galvanizes these organizations?
Exactly. I mean, social media has really made a big difference. John Lewis actually told a group of young organizers that, you know, that if they had social media back then, you know, the movement could have kept going. It could have stayed stronger because social media has such a strong influence and impact. You can just reach so many people with it. It has an incredible democratizing factor and a low-cost point. I mean, before, you had to hope that the TV camera showed up. Now people bring their cell phone cameras and they post it to YouTube and they tweet out the links. So you're able to circumvent mainstream media incredibly in order to get your message out.
Yeah, my RA dragged me into the 21st century a couple of years ago and said, Professor Armey, you got to get on Twitter. I say it was just before Trayvon Martin's verdict, in that case, the George Zimmerman verdict. And I was able to see, therefore, how after Ferguson, you kept seeing the pictures tweeted. You know, he's in the street still. It's been 3 hours. It's been 4 hours. And the national movement that Ferguson became was because of social media. There's no question. And it was incredibly powerful to see this wave and see the new power of this digital tool for fomenting real movements that can bring about the kind of change I talked about with that Pew Research poll as well as the Gallup poll.
It underscores, I think, certainly what Julian Bond did in his day with the Reverend Martin Luther Kings and the Jesse Jacksons and the Andy Youngs and all the other folks during the Civil Rights Movement who didn't have social media or hashtags or the way by which to get that word out. They were on the ground. They were connecting with people in the Birminghams and the Garys and the South Centrals and everywhere else across the country. So it does just underscore, I think, what Julian Bond did in his life, and we remember him today. Jody Armour, professor of law at USC, thank you so much for your time, Jody.
Thank you, Steve.
Danielle Belton, who writes for the website The Root. Danielle, thank you as well.
Thank you for having me.
The NAACP is treading in different waters for sure, but how different? And is the organization still relevant in the age of fast-responding black activism? Tell us what you think at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY or on Facebook at KCRW Press Play. Just ahead, a look back at Prop 39, passed a few years back to create new jobs in the green energy sector here in California. But a new report says it's come up short. That's coming up next on Press Play.
Make a donation of just a dollar a day and you can join one of our exciting and exclusive angel clubs. Choose from music, books, DVDs, or cookbooks delivered right to your front door. Learn more and join now at kcrw.com/join.
You're listening to Press Play on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis, sitting in for Madeline Brand. 3 years ago, nearly two-thirds of California voters passed Proposition 39. It was called the Clean Energy Jobs Act. The ballot measure sounded pretty great, actually. It would raise hundreds of millions of dollars by closing a corporate tax loophole, and all that new money would be used to create thousands of jobs working on green energy projects inside California schools. But has the promise been fulfilled? Julia Horowitz is a reporter for the Associated Press in Sacramento, and she's investigated how things have worked out so far for the Clean Energy Jobs Act, and she's with us right now. Hi, Julia.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
You bet. Your report card on Prop 39 isn't so good, so let's start with the jobs. When it was on the ballot in 2012, how many jobs were backers saying that the act would create?
There were a number of different estimates, but it all came in around 11,000 jobs per year. What ended up happening was a lot closer to 1,700 jobs total 3 years into the program.
What kind of jobs are we talking about? So that's just a fraction of what was promised.
That's about a tenth of what was promised, yeah. And the types of jobs isn't exactly what was pitched to voters either. So far, you see that a little over half of the money has gone to energy audits and consulting. So it's probably a lot more consulting jobs than it is construction. That being said, it is still in the very, you know, the earlier part of the implementation. So it's expected that more construction jobs will be created in the next couple of years. But you can't contest that the pace is much more sluggish.
It's much more sluggish, as you reported in your story. You say consultants, and all of a sudden my eyes glaze over a little bit. I mean, are these bureaucrats? Is that what we're talking about here?
I think it's hard to say. And the reason that it's hard to determine exactly what types of jobs have been created, and these are really just conjectures, is because the Energy Commission doesn't actually have these numbers. They are still collecting the data for what kind of jobs have been created, which projects have been completed. They were saying that information won't be available until the Oversight Committee meets. The Oversight Committee hasn't met because that information hasn't been available. So that's what's going on that front.
A spokeswoman, Amber Beck, I believe you said in the story, said she believes the program is on track. Is that correct?
That's correct. And in speaking to schools, everybody speaks very, very highly of this program. It was, you know, very sunny reports. The money is very much welcome at schools that have been cash-strapped, especially when it comes to building maintenance. Everyone really liked having this funding, but when you look at the numbers of what has actually been built, it's a little bit more concerning.
Well, let's talk about the funding. We talked about a fraction of the jobs have been created. What about the money that's come in?
So initially, this was supposed to bring in about $1 billion per year, and half of that, so $550 million, was going to go to the Clean Energy Jobs Fund. But the amount of money coming in has never passed $381 million. It was actually as low as $279 million in 2014. So legislative analysts say it's hard to predict how much money will come in when you close a corporate tax loophole. These corporations try to minimize their tax burdens. That's what they do.
They try and do that. They try and minimize the tax burdens. What are they doing? Are they finding creative ways to avoid paying these taxes the loopholes were supposed to cover?
That might be part of it. Also, it turns out that the number of corporations that this change actually affected is a pretty small number. It's not a huge number of multi-state corporations that were exploiting this tax loophole. It's, you know, a much smaller portion. And so what they're doing could disproportionately affect these numbers as well.
What about here in L.A., Julia? Has L.A. Unified applied for any of this money? What kinds of projects are going on there?
They have. So L.A. Unified School District has received the most funding out of all of the school districts, which makes sense because it's so large. So far, the state has sent them about $12.6 million. But if you look at what's actually been completed, there hasn't been a single project that's been done. They had two schools that were scheduled for lighting retrofits and heating and cooling upgrades this summer. But when we went to take pictures of these sites and look at progress done, they said that construction hadn't even started.
It hadn't even started, but it was being planned.
Exactly. And they have nearly 1,000 schools, and so.
Are we talking about a lot of red tape here? Is that why it's not happening? I mean, what's going on?
That's certainly a part of it. Energy advocates and the people who push this legislation say it would have been a catastrophe if we just sent this money straight out to schools. They need to plan. These things take time, and the long-term benefits are out there. But you have all these schools who, a lot of them, don't have really great energy data to begin with. So they're really starting from square zero, where they have to audit all of these schools. And the Energy Commission requires very in-depth reports from all of them. So then they have to outsource this to consultants and auditors. And these things take time. And I think that it's very easy to rationalize if you're on the government end of things. You know, that they say that's how these programs work. But from a taxpayer's perspective, it's a little bit more concerning.
Well, the program works by the oversight of a board, and the board hasn't met in 3 years. Why is that, and who's on this board?
There's 9 people on this board. They're appointed from a large variety of backgrounds. You have engineers, you have energy experts, people who are involved in academic energy research. And the people in the Energy Commission are saying it was way too early for them to meet. Not enough data has been collected. But as I mentioned, they weren't going to start collecting this data until the committee was ramping up to meet. So it's almost a catch-22.
What about the people who backed this Proposition 39 several years back? We had Kevin DeLeon, who's now president pro tem of the Senate, and Tom Steyer, of course, the billionaire here in the state. What are they saying?
They say everything is going as planned. They said it's expected that these things take time, that they wanted school districts to save up for bigger investments, and they're really defending the proposition and its progress.
All right. Julia Horowitz, reporter for the Associated Press in Sacramento. Julia, thanks.
Thank you so much for having me.
You bet. Coming up, we talk with our own Michael Schneider about Sesame Street headed to HBO and the glut of new TV shows.
I can't sleep anymore, Steve. There's no time to sleep because there is a lot of television.
A lot indeed. A lot on this program, too. That's just ahead after a news update with Jennifer Wolfe.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Steve Chiotakis, sitting in for Madeline Brand. Unless you've been living in a garbage can, you probably heard about Big Bird's big move to pay TV. That's right, Sesame Street is joining the network of Tony Soprano and Nucky Thompson. TV's a strange place anyway, on and off the small screen, and we're going to talk about that odd development, a possible Fresh Prince reboot, and insane plot twists on the underground hit Mr. Robot. Michael Schneider is chief content officer for TV Guide magazine, and he's co-host, of course, of KCRW's A Spinoff. Hey, Michael.
Hi, Steve.
I want to start off with this. I guess it was kind of stunning news that came out just a few days ago that HBO has picked up Sesame Street.
Oh, very stunning news. You know, Sesame Street apparently now has moved next door to Boardwalk Empire. This was a game changer and kind of shocking, kind of depressing at the same time that this is where we find ourselves now that, you know, Sesame Workshop, which produces Sesame Street, can't support the show anymore. And so HBO, thankfully, came in to save the day, but that's opened up a whole new bag of questions.
A lot of questions. The first one is, am I still going to be able to see it on PBS? And the answer, I guess the short answer is yes.
Yes. As a matter of fact, HBO's deal allows PBS to air episodes 9 months after they originally air on HBO, and they'll continue to air repeats as well. And honestly, most of the episodes of Sesame Street your kids are already watching are repeats. They only produce 18 new episodes a year, so most of the time what you're seeing is something that was produced maybe in 2012 or 2013.
How much money do you think the producers of the show will make from the deal?
Well, it'll bring millions into the coffers, which is necessary because the big issue for Sesame Workshop is they already get most of their money from licensing and merchandising. Mm-hmm. Only about 10% of their funding came from PBS and from public broadcasting to begin with. So that was fine for a long time as people picked up their Sesame Street DVDs and wore their Oscar the Grouch t-shirts and what have you. But a lot of that's dried up. People don't buy DVDs anymore. And a lot of the merchandising sort of went by the wayside. People just aren't buying as much Sesame Street stuff as they used to. So Sesame Workshop really found themselves in a pickle.
In a pickle. And I wonder, Michael, because when Sesame Street came out, when was it? The early 70s, wasn't it?
Yeah, I believe it was 1969.
69. So yeah. Before the 70s, when it came out, it wasn't about merchandising, though. It wasn't about, certainly not DVDs, but it wasn't about all of that. It was about educating kids.
Right, right. And specifically, it was about educating inner city kids and low-income kids especially. The merchandising came later. I think it came pretty early on. I remember being a kid and actually playing with Sesame Street toys.
So, you were?
So that's been around since at least the 70s. But, I think the mission has evolved through the years as kids have changed. And television obviously has changed as well. A lot more different outlets now for even lower-income kids, but for all kids to be educated on television.
I was having a conversation with somebody and they were asking me, well, what does this do for HBO? Why are we putting it on the same network as, you know, these other guys, and a lot of sex and drugs and, you know, violence and action-packed TV shows and all of that? And I said, well, you know, HBO was also the network of Fraggle Rock, right?
Right,
and
right.
Baybar, the elephant.
And there is an HBO Family channel, actually. But the big issue is, a lot of people who, you know, our age who watch HBO have kids. And, you know, this is an opportunity now for HBO subscribers to put their kids in front of HBO as well. But the big issue, Steve, is Netflix. It, like everything else now, every conversation in television has to do with Netflix, pretty much. And it's this case as well. Netflix has a big deal with Disney coming in 2016, where Netflix is going to have all the Disney movies, Disney programming, all sorts of stuff. HBO, especially now with their HBO Now app, is in the game as well. And so they need to counterbalance that. So, you know, it's sort of the cherry on top for people who are thinking about, okay, do I want to subscribe to HBO or do I want to subscribe to Netflix or both? Well, HBO, okay, it has all the shows that I want, but it also has Sesame Street for my kids. So you know what? Okay, I'll pop down the $8-$10 a month for it.
From Sesame Street to Will Smith, and some disheartening, perhaps, TV news. There are rumblings that there seems to be, at least, the idea of a reboot of Will Smith's 1990s sitcom Fresh Prince of Bel-Air.
Nothing is sacred anymore, Steve. But we saw that a long time ago. They're remaking Full House. They're remaking Coach. They're bringing back X-Files. They're bringing back Prison Break. Everything is being remade.
Where are the original ideas in Hollywood? Why do we have to remake everything?
Well, the bottom line is there's a lot of TV out there. There's a lot of entertainment, period. When you think about video games and YouTube and everything else that's sort of competing for your time. So basically the only thing that people may even like take notice of these days is a familiar product, a familiar name, familiar intellectual property. So if you're a network, do you want to promote something no one's ever heard of before, or do you want to promote Fresh Prince of Bel-Air that everyone's heard of? So that's why everyone's sort of going to familiar properties, be it books or TV shows or movies.
To be sure, Will Smith is the one proposing this. Is he saying that he wants one of his kids to play him?
I think he would be fine with that because he apparently is their chief employer these days. He puts them in all his movies and TV shows. But to be fair, this is still early stages. It's just being pitched right now. It's not set up at a network yet. So there's no guarantee we're actually going to see a Fresh Prince of Bel-Air reboot.
Let's turn to some other television, perhaps better television. There's a lot of buzz about the USA original series, Mr. Robot. It's this kind of paranoid cyber thriller. I mean, no spoilers here, but what is it about this show that's got people talking?
Yeah, it's kind of become the show of the summer. And what's exciting is it's a new kind of show for USA Network. It's very different. You know, USA Network's known for their blue sky shows like Royal Pains and White Collar and all these shows with an adjective and a pronoun or a noun. But this is very different. It's dark. It's moody. Remy Malek plays the lead character, who's this sort of slightly off-kilter, very underground hacker who gets mixed up with a group of other hackers who are looking to take down a big conglomerate called Evil Corp. Their ambitions are good, but the fallout has been very dramatic, very ugly, and a lot of good people are actually getting caught up now in sort of they're trying to take down this big company. So the question is, do the ends justify the means?
It's interesting to me that USA ordered two seasons of this show before the first episode even aired. Do you think that bet is paying off?
Well, the bet is definitely paying off now. If you believe in a show like this, you have to invest in it. And because this is a new kind of show for USA, they knew it was going to take time to get their traditional viewers to stick around. And luckily they are.
You've been asking this question, a big question in TV Guide and the spinoff. Is there too much television? Do we have too much TV right now?
I can't sleep anymore, Steve. There's no time to sleep because there is a lot of television. And, there are some people out there, including John Landgraf, who's the head of FX Networks, who believes that there is going to be a shakeout at some point, that we have reached, in his words, peak television, that there's just too much for people to watch. And at some point, that means that there are going to be fewer eyeballs on these shows. Advertising dollars will go down, and not everyone's going to be able to remain in the original series game. And I, for one, will breathe a sigh of relief. That doesn't mean that everything's great, but there is a lot of great television as a result of that. So that's a good thing. And it's a high-class problem to have, but nonetheless, it makes it a little harder to decide what to watch.
How is all this programming actually changing, do you think, the medium? How is it changing the business of making TV? Can you still make money while making 400-plus scripted shows?
Well, the big question is, a lot of these shows, they're not traditional broadcast network shows that go for 22, 24 episodes a season. We're seeing a lot more shows go for 8, 10, 12 episodes a season, which is fine, but that makes it harder for traditional syndication because, you need to have a lot more episodes in order to sell it in traditional broadcast syndication. Now, you've got Netflix and Amazon coming along, and they're buying shows with not as many episodes, and so that's helping to some degree these producers still make money. But, the big riches that people made from the Seinfelds and the Big Bang Theories and the Friends of the World, we may see less of that.
Do you remember back in the 90s when the big cable companies were saying there were going to be 500 channels. You're going to have so many choices. And we were like, yeah, sure, right, And here we are.
Right. Well, basically every YouTube channel is a different channel. So we're in the millions at this point, Steve. Not to panic you or anything.
We don't have enough eyes or enough brain space, I think.
Not at all. Not at all.
Michael Schneider from TV Guide Magazine. Michael, thank you for your time.
Thanks a lot, Steve.
The Dodgers kick off a series against the Oakland A's up in the Bay Area tomorrow. And entering into that interleague series, the Dodgers are leading the National League West, which they also did last year. Not that it mattered, because the Dodgers were then bounced by the Cardinals in the postseason. But with the biggest payroll in the majors, an ownership group that paid $2 billion for the team a few years ago, and an $8 billion deal with Time Warner Cable, the Dodgers do win the money game. Molly Knight wrote the book The Best Team Money Can Buy, which chronicles how the boys in blue are rolling in the green. And when I recently spoke with Molly, I started by asking her about the former owners of the Dodgers, the O'Malley family. When the O'Malleys owned the team, and they owned the team for a long, long time, they brought them to Los Angeles from Brooklyn more than 50 years ago. Did anyone know this could be quite the golden egg?
I think they must. Of course they did. I think that was part of the reason why O'Malley left Brooklyn. Even though the Dodgers were so popular there, there was this idea that in the West it was full of endless possibility and opportunity. And so, yeah, they came out here. The Giants came out here, and they launched professional sports on the West Coast.
On the West Coast. The O'Malleys, of course, famously sold the team to Rupert Murdoch and Fox, who then sold the team a few years later to Frank McCourt, who was reviled in Los Angeles, to say
mildly.
The least. Putting it mildly. Why didn't McCourt spend the money to bring the team to championship caliber? Do you think he did? Did he try?
It didn't matter. He said he was going to him to win. I mean, he said he was going to keep the payroll in the top quarter of all payrolls, and he didn't. He broke every promise that he made. He just wanted to be able to use the team as his own personal ATM. He had no other businesses. Like some of these owners that you see coming in, like a Steve Ballmer or Mark Cuban, these guys are rich on their own merits, and they don't need to take up loans against future season tickets to build a mansion in Malibu like McCourt did.
And he still owns the parking lot, doesn't he?
He does.
He does,
yeah.
I mentioned $2 billion for the team, the Guggenheim, the investment firm, paid. Do fans notice that, do you think? Do they feel a connection that $2 billion was paid for their baseball team?
I don't know if they do. I think, unfortunately, with this TV deal being kind of a mess because of the Time Warner Comcast merger and the AT&T DirecTV merger, I think a lot of fans have felt a little bit disconnected. And it's a weird thing because, on the one hand, that TV deal is what allows them to go out and spend $270 million on payroll. But then it's like, if some fans aren't able to watch, which would you rather have? I think it's going to be resolved shortly now that the AT&T DirecTV merger is happening. And then, yeah, I think fans will absolutely feel that connection.
If they feel that connection, of course, when we say Time Warner, the deal meant that 70% of Los Angeles was unable to see Dodgers games
right.
that were regularly on KCAL-9. They removed them from broadcast TV. And to be sure, there is a pending merger between Time
right.
Warner and Charter Communications.
Right.
Going
and
forward.
I didn't write about it in my book because, honestly, books have to be done. early there, like blog posts, unfortunately.
And things change,
too,
by publishing time.
We all thought it was going to be taken care of by now.
What you did write in your book was about visiting Clayton Kershaw at his big Texas home,
yeah,
right?
Uh-huh.
As big as the state of Texas on the day of a huge contract extension, which
yes.
I think is ironic as well. Number one, how did you get access? And what was he like? Did he look and sound like Boy Wonder on the mound?
Well, so I've known Clayton since he came up. Since he came up to the big leagues, I've been around. I reported for ESPN for quite a while before I left to write this book. And I think with Clayton, he's very guarded. He's pretty shy and private. And I think he saw that I had built relationships with some of the veterans on the team, some of the guys he looked up to, like a Mark Ellis, a Skip Schumacher, an AJ Ellis. And he sort of warmed to me. And then as the season went on, he knew that I knew stuff about him that he had told me off the record that I did not report. I knew that they pulled him into a bunker and offered him $300 million, 15 years plus a lifetime contract. And he knew that I knew that. And he asked me, he said, please, you know, don't reported. I don't believe in playing the media and in operating that way. He's a straight shooter and he doesn't like games. I knew it off the record, so I'm not gonna burn my source that way. So then it just so happened, and maybe that was my karma and luck that I had coming back, because when we set up our interview in the off season, when I said I'll go to your house, we picked a day in January and I showed up. And I walked in and sat down. It was the two of us at his kitchen table. His wife had gone out to get groceries. And 3 minutes later, his cell phone rattled against the table, and it was his agent. And he picked up the phone, and I heard the whole thing. And the agent said, congratulations, Clayton, your deal is done.
And that was a $300 million deal, 15 years?
Well, what it wound up being was he didn't want to sign that deal because, as he explained to me, he could not fathom signing a contract until he was 40. It just seemed like way too long. And he doesn't want to be that guy who signs that big deal and then he's terrible. And then he feels like he's not living up to it and he gets booed and all that.
So the deal was fewer years and less money.
7 years, 215.
215 million.
Yeah.
Kershaw didn't have the best divisional series against the Cardinals in the postseason last year. I can, my nerves can attest to that.
Yes.
And that feeds.
So can mine.
I think that feeds into general manager Stan Kasten, who apparently likes to hold on to money as mm-hmm. much as possible.
Yes.
Saying that highly paid players often disappoint or
yes.
often get hurt.
Yes. He told me, I hate paying players. It's almost as if, he feels like he's the one writing a check from his own banking account. It's how much he hates paying players. And he had this joke because Kasten, for those of you who don't know, he ran the Braves during their dynasty in the 90s, 80s, 90s.
Bobby Cox.
Yes.
Yeah.
And he has this running joke that he went from that their payroll never topped 100 million to a team with a payroll of over 200 million. So he jokes that like he never had a payroll in the 100 millions.
And there was no inflation, I guess, since then either.
No, yeah. No. But he's right, because you can't just patch holes in your system by going out and overpaying for free agents. The problem with free agents is you're paying for past performance, and they most of the time don't live up to that. So he's held on to some of these prospects that are going to come up and be fantastic, and the Dodgers will get back to what they used to do, which was, you know, promote homegrown talent and have a strong foundation like the Cardinals are doing.
Right, with the farm system. The
right.
farm system, very important. Can money buy a championship, do you think? George Steinbrenner, the Yankees certainly mm-hmm. did it. I mean, will we see it with the Dodgers?
I think it can, yes. I think money can buy a championship, because what money can do is give you room for error. If you sign a guy like the Dodgers did this year, they signed Brandon McCarthy, Brett Anderson, they have Hyunjin Ryu. McCarthy and Rue are out for the season with injuries. Anderson had a scare the other day with an Achilles.
Yeah.
They can afford to go out and, say, trade for a Cole Hamels and take on that money, whereas the Rays could never do that. The Pirates would have a hard time with that. That being said, you have to spend it wisely. You can't just throw money at the problem and expect to win. You've got to have a strong farm system, because as soon as guys get hurt, you have to be able to replace from within.
Is it worth it, do you think? I mean, the Cubs keep losing, right? I mean, and their fans keep coming. They're redoing Wrigley Field.
Right. It's worth it. They're getting over 300. People don't understand. Forbes, it drives me bananas. Forbes values the Dallas Cowboys as the most valuable franchise in American sports. The Cowboys have to share television revenue with the rest of the NFL equally, because the NFL makes deals with Fox, NBC, ABC, all that. Each team got about $187 million in television revenue last year. The Dodgers are going to get over $330 million. So if you think about it, it's like they could pay for their payroll and still have $60 million left over before a single ticket is sold, before a single hot dog is bought or a Michelada or whatever they sell, those popcorn dogs or the churro dogs,
before
any of those are sold. So it seems like, yeah, go out and try to win, and then that just builds the brand even more.
And $2 billion doesn't seem like that much money in the end.
Right.
Molly Knight, who wrote the book The Best Team Money Can Buy, The Los Angeles Dodgers' Wild Struggle to Build a Baseball Powerhouse. Interesting story. Obviously, it's one of LA's teams. Molly Knight, thanks.
Thank you so much for having me. This was fun.
We have another show coming up on KCRW in about 15 minutes, and that's Warren Olney in To The Point. Hi, Warren.
Hello, Steve. Nice to see you sitting here.
Nice to see you sitting with me.
Well, we're going to be talking about the outsiders versus the insiders in the presidential campaign, and the big question is, how long are these outsiders going to last, particularly Donald Trump, of course, not to mention the doctor in the Republican scene, against all those governors and senators who nobody seems to care much about. And on the other side, we have Bernie Sanders, who describes himself as an independent. That's what he is in the U.S. Senate, even though he's not an outsider in the sense that he's been in the Senate. But he's a socialist as well. And that puts him politically on the outside. Are these candidacies going to last? And there are people on both sides who think, yes, they probably will, longer than you might have thought of when this all got underway.
Looking forward to that, Warren Olney. And To The Point, coming up in about 15 minutes here on KCRW. Coming up on our show, would you eat deep-fried butter to win the White House? Funnel cakes, oh, how your waistline would suffer. But body-conscious candidates are keeping it real on the ground while keeping the pounds off. That's next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Steve Chiatakis, sitting in for Madeline Brand. The 2016 presidential hopefuls hit the Iowa State Fair over the weekend. Along with the usual stump speeches and photo ops, they also chowed down. Sort of. Donald Trump took one bite of a pork chop on a stick Saturday. One bite. Jeb Bush, meanwhile, ate only half of his deep-fried Snickers bar. Would they be better off pigging out on the whole thing is the question here. It might sound silly, but the food that candidates eat on the campaign trail is more politically charged than ever. Indulging in local treats is a way to demonstrate relatability, right? But it's also a liability when keeping fit is a priority as well. Maren Kogan is a contributing editor at New York Magazine. Her latest story is called The Politics of Presidential Dieting, and she's with me right now. Hi, Maren.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well and hungry. You wrote that this this batch of candidates is the most body conscious that we've seen. Jeb Bush recently lost a lot of weight, he says, on the paleo diet, as it were. Chris Christie, of course, famously had the lap band surgery. Who else is on a regimen here?
Well, Scott Walker is using his Fitbit. Bobby Jindal is talking a lot about his gym rat proclivities. he also got into a push-up contest with BuzzFeed recently. Rick Perry is challenging Donald Trump to a pull-up contest. This is really a very body-conscious bunch.
I can think of other analogies here, but I won't say it on the radio. Why do you think the current contenders, Maren, are so fitness-focused?
Well, you know, in the last couple of campaigns, we've seen this sort of turn towards a more fitness-focused presidential race. You had Obama in 08 and again in 2012, regularly featured shirtless on the beach in Hawaii. You had the vice presidential nominee for the Republicans last time sort of showing off his P90X sculpted body in Time magazine.
Famously.
This is, I think, indicative of a broader cultural shift towards being more fitness focused that we've had in our culture over the last 10 years or so. But it's a little fraught for these candidates because they also have to eat these fried things to sort of convey a comfort with the people in the places that they're campaigning in.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I mean, I suspect arugula is not the main feed over there at the Iowa State Fair or kale. I mean, there's pressure, especially among Republicans, not to appear elitist.
Right. You remember the arugula thing was something that Obama was weirdly slammed for again and again in 2008. Right. And in Iowa, everything is fried and on a stick, right? And P people are so passionate. I mean, everyone is so passionate about their food. This is sort of one of the things that unites and divides us more than anything else is our opinions about food. So what you eat really does sort of send a cultural message, which makes it a little tricky for these guys.
And over the next 15 months, Maren, I suspect, you know, I mean, it's not just Iowa. They're going to be headed to South Carolina. They're going to be headed to, you know, all other Nebraska and Ohio and all these places. And they're going to be kissing babies and eating a lot of food.
And drinking beer, too.
And drinking beer. Hillary Clinton, as a matter of fact, famously taking a picture with a beer in her hand. You want to drink a beer with Hillary. Is there a difference between how men and women are treated in this area?
Oh, yes. It's very different. I think there is more of a cultural consensus now against not shaming the women candidates for their, or at least there will be a lot of backlash for those that try it. But the other thing to consider is that we just have so few, we have two women running for president, right, which is an almost unheard of number. And the pressures are so much higher for women in public life that it's almost impossible to imagine sort of women who don't fit the conventional norm of attractiveness even being at that level. So it's a totally sort of different situation, but it is a sort of interesting conundrum for the men because they both have to live to these expectations now and also, again, not lose that common touch.
Well, I suspect the expectation game is not that much different if you ask, say, Chris Christie, right? People have slammed him for being overweight. There have been questions about whether he's too overweight, too obese to be president, which I think is interesting.
Yeah, I think it's stupid. I'll just say that flat out. I mean, I think it's silly that we, you know, but this is totally something that he has had to face. Legitimate questions raised in the media about whether or not he is too fat to be president. And that is something that, you know, it's a little bit harder to imagine that happening with a female candidate. But again, there are two women candidates running. So it's really, and they're both, you know, sort of within the norms of conventional attractiveness. So it's very hard to imagine that even coming up for them.
I suspect also Hillary Clinton, right? Didn't she take the people criticized her for wearing pantsuits? She didn't wear dresses. She wore pantsuits. And so she sort of made it a mantra of her campaign, didn't she?
Yeah. Well, I mean, my joke is sort of that, you know, we've reached this consensus against not shaming the female presidential candidates, but it only took a lifetime of sexist criticism about her hair and her makeup and her clothes to get there. But she has really done her campaign, too, has done a really good job of turning these things that used to be considered criticisms of her and making her a sort of cultural icon, a sort of feminist cultural icon with it.
I may be going over some heads, but I do remember Bill Clinton campaigning in 91, 92 for president. And he was running, he was jogging to McDonald's to go eat an Egg McMuffin or a Big Mac.
Yeah, I think the Bill Clinton example is great. He is really sort of the last president to get to walk this line of sort of beer-drinking Bubba, guy who jogs straight to McDonald's, and, you know, the sort of everyman who you want to have a beer with. But look at what happened to him. He's vegan now. He's photographed in Washington, D.C., walking around in his pink sneakers. The demands of his health eventually won out. And I think that that's sort of a cultural moment we're in, too. Everyone is much more health conscious now. And, you know, that pressure is there for the candidates, too.
Everyone is health conscious, Maren. But I wonder, do you really think voters care about what candidates are eating? Do they really care? Are they really watching this?
I don't think they care that much. I think the thing is, it can become a huge thing in the media. And there can be these really sort of, I think, silly expectations placed on them. You know, there was a New York Times article about Jeb Bush's paleo diet, in which it said that his, you know, his carb dodging habits risk putting him in danger of voters who want a more relatable eater in chief. And really, is that really happening? Are people Googling the diets of presidential candidates and worrying seriously that they're not a relatable eater? I don't think so, but it is evidence of the pressures that are there for them now.
Well, I wonder, are there communications teams out there, the Jeb Bush team, or, you know, what, some war room out there in some political campaign worried about what the candidate is eating?
I think so. And I think that is probably never on display more than right now, where they're all expected to eat these sort of fried foods on a stick. I think there's a lot of talk going on about avoiding the corn dogs and how to eat things. And I think this is probably the biggest test that they will have.
Maren Kogan, a contributing editor for New York Magazine. I'm still hungry, Maren, by the way. I'm ready for some lunch. Absolutely. Thank you for your time today. We appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
All right. Jolie Myers has some feedback for us from today's show and other shows. And hi, Jolie.
Hi.
Are you hungry after that?
Yes. I think the question is whether or not, not whether or not I would eat fried butter, but how much I would
eat. How much? Like a whole pound?
This should surprise no one, but I would. I would for days. So we asked our listeners, does it matter to you what a candidate eats on the campaign trail? Why do we need our candidates to act like our corn dog eating drinking buddies? Why is this a thing? Stephanie Strigel says on Facebook that she is so sick of this conversation in the media focusing on the fried Snickers factor. She can't wait for us to start talking about actual issues. I promise, Stephanie, that is on the way. Scolding aside, Opus does not care what the candidates eat. It's more important to set an example for the country. Rather, Opus does care. It sets an example. Eat healthily, recycle whatever is left. That's the kind of president that Opus wants. And Sandra T says she doesn't care what they're eating as long as their mouths are too full to speak.
Ooh.
So she's over the conversation completely. So, Steve, I know you've been to one of these state fairs. What's the craziest thing you've had
the craziest
eat.
Thing I've ever I don't know how you deep fry butter. I don't know how you do that, like, without it melting
the
and
science
just being
of it?
A big mess.
Parlance of politicians, I'm not a scientist, but
yeah you're gonna try that. You're gonna talk climate change right now, is that what you're gonna do?
Well, it's been such a pleasure having you on
Jolie,
today, Steve.
It's been a pleasure here as well. Thank you so much. Jolie Myers with feedback. You can check us out anytime at our Facebook page, KCRW. Press play. That's it for us today. I'm Steve Chiotakis in for Madeline Brand. Have a great rest of your Monday.